fellow griever. You have found the Leftover Pieces Suicide Loss Conversations podcast, and I am Melissa, your host. I am with you on this journey because my 21-year-old son, Alex, died by suicide on August 7th of 2016. Since launching this podcast in late 2020, I have followed my heart and expanded the Leftover Pieces to include books and an online community where I host Zoom support groups every week. It is there, in this community, that I lead other parents who have lost a child by suicide from survival toward hope and into healing. The website is also a resource hub, a connecting point for all survivors of suicide loss. You can find me, ways to connect with me, and links to everything that I'm doing in the community on my website, theleftoverpieces.com. Know that I'm always open to suggestions and feedback. And if you know someone that I should connect with to be on the podcast, please let me know that as well. So now, I invite you to join me for real conversations, candid talk on hard topics surrounding the loss of our loved ones by suicide. I talk to other loss survivors, mental health experts, advocates, and on alternate weeks, I offer shorter solo episodes where I go down the rabbit hole to discuss things that have been on my mind or possibly parts of my journey that I feel would be beneficial to share. Every week, we explore the questions that haunt us, seek the courage to uncover the healing tools within us, and offer the comfort of a community that we all need so very much. It's true that our hearts and lives have been shattered, but come along with me, and together, let's choose to find meaning and even happiness amid the leftover pieces before us. Welcome. Hello, fellow grievers, and welcome to Season 5, Episode 8 of the Leftover Pieces Suicide Loss Conversations podcast, and I'm Melissa, your host. Today, I welcome a brave, amazing young woman named Bobby Smith to the podcast. Bobby is 22 years old and has lost both her best friend and husband to suicide. And yet, I find the hope in her voice to be truly inspirational. Raceland was Bobby's childhood best friend. Raceland died by suicide on February 20th of 2018 at just 16 years old. While Bobby says that she often felt the support of her family and the adults in her life, her world was completely rocked, and she even ended up completing her school online due to the bully-like and sensitive behavior of the peers in her life after Raceland died, many of which knew both of them. Bobby met Quentin, her future husband, through Raceland. They were online friends for years. She knew about him a little through Raceland, but that changed after Raceland passed when they became closer. Quentin and her stayed in contact on social media, and he offered support and said he'd always be there to talk. It turned out he was, and their connection grew. After high school in 2020, she started dating Quentin somewhat unofficially, but after a road trip to visit Bobby in October of 2020, he asked her to be his girlfriend. And they were married just over a year later in December of 2021. At the time, Quentin was a Marine stationed at Camp Pendleton, where he was at from 2018 to 2022 during his enlistment. Quentin Reed Smith was an 0331 machine gunner, infantryman in the United States Marines. He served one deployment to Japan. When he left the military, he was an E4 corporal. Still, he was an E3 Lance Corporal for most of his career. Just 4 months after turning 24 and 9 months after being out of the Marines, Quentin died from suicide by firearm in their backyard on August 14th of 2023. In this episode, you will hear this brave young woman talk about what was different the day he died, or was there anything different? We talk about the detrimental attitude towards mental health care while enlisted is a contributing factor to military and veteran suicides, in her opinion. We talk about why she blames the military and their lack of support ultimately for his death, including but not limited to the fact that they do such a poor job reacclimating soldiers back into civilian life once they get out. We candidly discuss the concepts of fear and ignorance and what she believes would help or could be done differently for soldiers and ultimately for people struggling at large, and how she thinks we can all make a difference. There are a lot of takeaways from this episode, so let's get started and meet Bobby. Hi, Bobby. Thanks so much for being a guest on the podcast today.
Of course. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, so everybody just got to hear a little bit about you and what brought you to reach out to me and ask to be a guest on the podcast, which it's such a mixed feeling for me because it means that you've had a loss. In your case, you've had two very significant losses in a short period of time. But I also feel honored to be able to talk to people that are willing to share their story. So I would like to start today the same way I start all of my episodes like this and let you share your loss story, Bobby.
I will start with my friend. I have unfortunately had two losses. My first one was Raceland, and my story with her is we were best friends since fifth grade. And we would talk almost every single day, even when she was moving to North Dakota, Missouri, back to Arizona. We were just inseparable. She moved to Cuba, Missouri in 2017. Where the start of the school year, that's where her family's from, so she wanted to move closer to be with family. We would talk every single day on the phone, and that was normal. So on the 19th of February, I got a call from Raceland, again, just like any normal day, and she was just asking me about my day and telling me about her day and just talking, and probably talked for about an hour. And then she said, goodbye and I love you and I'll talk to you tomorrow. And I didn't think anything of it because, again, that was our normal phone call. So I told her I love her and I'll talk to her tomorrow. And she hung up. The next day, I didn't hear from her all day, and I was sitting on the couch watching a movie with my mom, and I picked up my phone and I saw that I had a missed call from her mom. And I was like, oh, that's weird. Let me call Raceland to see why her mom was calling me. So I called Raceland and there was no answer. So I was like, okay, I will call her mom again. And so I called her mom and there was no answer. And then her grandma had left me a voicemail that I saw, and I read that and it was just, Bobby, will you please reach out to us? So her mom finally called me back and she answered the phone, and I could tell she was very upset. And she said, Bobby, can I talk to your mom? I said, okay. I handed the phone to my mom, and immediately she just starts crying, and I didn't even have to ask her what was wrong. I knew what was wrong, and I just break down. And my mom goes in the other room and finishes talking to her mom on the phone to figure out what happened. But I had just already knew, and that is how I found out that she died by suicide. And then it was just a whole whirlwind of events after that. Thankfully, I was able to fly to attend her funeral, which I am extremely grateful that I was able to go, since being all the way in Arizona, being 16. And that is my lost story with Raceland. My second one is my husband, Quentin. I met Quentin through Raceland. They were friends for years. They were online friends, and they had never, unfortunately, had the opportunity to meet in person. I knew of Quentin, and I knew about Quentin. She talked about him all the time. They were really good friends. And when Raceland passed away, Quentin reached out to me on social media and just reached out and said that he was sorry for my loss and that he hopes that we could keep in touch and just check in on one another. And I really appreciated that, which we did. We did for years. From 2018 on, we would talk at least once a month. He just asked me how I was doing, asked me how school was, and just check in on each other, have a short conversation. And that's how it was until the summer after I graduated. It's the summer of 2020. And he said, we should talk more. And we did. And we started dating on October 10th of 2020. And we got married a little over a year later on December 11th of 2021. He was at the time in the Marine Corps, and I moved to California, Mission Viejo, to be with him after we got married. And we lived there until he got out of the service. I believe it was November of 2022. He got out, and we moved all the way back to his home state of Oklahoma. So we moved to Oklahoma City. And we lived there. He started working at Herzog as a mechanical technician for their streetcars. And I started working at a daycare. And we lived there in the same house from December until August. Backtracking a little bit, he had started a new schedule. So he was working, doing extra training from midnight till 8 a.m. in the morning. So the day before, on Sunday, he had worked his old schedule, which was 3 a.m. till around, it was 8 a.m. or noon. It was around noon that morning. He came home. I went to an event at my job. It was Meet the Teacher night. Then we met at home. It was a normal Sunday. I did grocery shopping, talked to him like he was normal. He was going to take a nap because he had to get up and be at work at midnight until 8 a.m. So he took a nap on the couch, and I woke him up at 11:30, and I gave him a hug, bye, and it was just a normal night. I was asking him, what did he want for dinner that week? And what did you want for lunch? I was going to pack his lunch the next day. And so I packed his lunch. We figured out which days we're going to go for dinner and make for dinner that week. And then sent him to work. And he got off at 8 a.m. the next day, and he went home. It was the first day of our new student. So usually I'm able to check my phone every now and again to see if anybody called me. Because I've had emergencies in the past, but I just want to make sure that I'm able to see my phone every now and then. Well, that morning it was so busy, new students, and I didn't check my phone all morning. So I think it was around 9:30. One of the people from the office came in and said, "Bobby, your husband's on the phone. He says it's an emergency." And I said, "Okay." And I answer the phone, and it's him, and he's in kind of a panic, and he's just rambling on about many different things. And then he asked me, while I was at work, I stepped out of the classroom to take the phone call. He asked me where my gun was. And I said, well, why do you, that started to cause me to panic. I said, why do you need that if it's in this place? But you already know that. Why do you need to ask me that? And then he just kept going and he hung up. I immediately start having a panic attack because I'm confused. I don't know what's happening. I don't know why you asked me that question. So I go into the office and I get out as much as I can. I said, you have the address to my house. I need to leave. Can somebody go back into the classroom and grab my things? I don't want to go back in there with the kids like this. So one of them goes into the office to my classroom to grab my phone and keys and everything. And then I said, can somebody send a welfare check to my house? They have my address. And so then one of them starts calling the police and asking them to send a welfare check to my house. They bring my things back and I run out the door and I call him on my way and he answers again. And again, it's just rambling, not really making any sense, repeating the same things, just not his normal behavior at all. And I'm in a panic, but I'm trying to talk him out of it. Panic and panic don't go well together. So I was trying my best to remain calm and figure out what was wrong. And he was just, you know, going off on a tangent and I was just trying to make sense of it all. And he hangs up again. And when he hung up that time, I was able to call my mother-in-law. And she was at work, and I said, I think Quentin's going to hurt himself. You're closer than I am. They worked at the same company. Can you please get there? I'm trying to go as fast as I can. So she immediately goes, and then I call our roommate, and he doesn't answer the phone. And so then I call him back, and he answers, and this time he was very calm and just telling me he loved me and was telling me everything was going to be okay. And part of that scared me, but then part of it comforted me because I was panicking. But I was like, maybe he's calmed down. Maybe he's okay. And then he hangs up again. I try to call him again and he doesn't answer. So this time I call the police and I am asking if they're there yet. And they say, no, they're not there yet. And I was 20 minutes away when my work is 20 minutes away. So, and his work, where my mother-in-law also worked, was only 10 minutes away. So I was like, maybe she got there. Maybe that's why he didn't answer the phone. Maybe the police got there. So over the phone, they told me, when you get there, the police have arrived. When you get there, do not get out of the car. A police officer will come meet you at your car. Hesitantly, I was like, okay. And when I got there, my mother-in-law pulled up at the same time. And we both get out of our cars and try to rush up to the house and the police stop us and say, you can't go in the house. You can't go in the backyard. We're like, what's going on? Tell us what's going on. And then our roommate, his best friend, comes out of the house and sits down on the porch and puts his head in his hands. And I just start bawling because I know. It's like the second time. Nobody has to say anything to me. You just know. I just knew. And I looked at him and I was like, is there anything we can do? Or is he gone? And he said, he's gone. And me and my mother-in-law, we just fall down onto my front lawn and are just screaming and crying and just inconsolable. And the events after that are a lot it's just a lot unfolded after that and having to make phone calls and everything with that. But that is how I found out that my husband passed, and it was by gunshot wound.
Bobby, I'm not rendered speechless very often. However, this is a lot. This is a lot for anybody to experience. However, and I want to say that our years on the earth shouldn't matter, but they do. You were very young. You were 16 years old when you lost Raceland. And you are just, how old are you now? 22. Okay.
Yeah.
It's a lot. And first of all, thank you for your bravery in being here. I couldn't be sorrier for both losses. This is a brave step, and I hope it's a brave step in your own healing. I think it's going to be powerful for people to listen to, because I know we've had a conversation prior to this, and I think you have some really valuable things to share from your experience. I have some questions for you, and I just appreciate you being here and being willing to do this. After losing, and this is a little different because you've had two losses, we're not just talking about the loss of Raceland or the loss of Quentin, we're talking about the loss mm-hmm. of both of them. And we will do some talking about one or the other as we go along, and probably a little bit more about Quentin since he was your husband and was more recent. And there's some more impactful things that we want to talk about with his loss, not to by any means shadow Raceland's loss at all. So let's talk first of all about you being 16 years old and losing your best friend, someone you talk to every day, which in effect puts them at the level of almost feeling like a sibling-ish to you. Mm-hmm. Talk about how that impacted you as such a young person. And I say that because as a woman who's 55 years old and comes from a generation where suicide wasn't really an option for us growing up, not to say it didn't happen once in a great while, but most of my generation went through school not knowing of anybody that we went to school with that died by suicide. Most of us didn't have anyone in our world that had died by suicide. It was not as common of a way to die. And if somebody did die by suicide, it was usually covered up a little bit more, even more than it would be. I mean, now it comes with the stigma, but it's not covered up as often. When I was growing up, it just wasn't in our thinking process. Because of all the things, a more populated world, computer and technology have a huge part of this, because your generation grew up not knowing a world without a supercomputer in your hands, right? Cell phones have been a thing since you were young. And that has changed a lot with what people are exposed to, the ideas that come to their minds, the things that they see. And you are now part of a generation, unfortunately, that suicide is something that's a very real part of your world, as far as knowing, hearing of people that die by suicide, knowing that, I don't want to say knowing that it's an option, but that's true. No, feeling like it's an option to when things get hard. And so I realize this question is probably a little different for you than I would feel like it might be for somebody my age, but somehow to what you're going to answer with talking about your biggest challenge at 16 with Raceland dying, I'm hoping on the heels of that, you can maybe address the whole idea that suicide is so much more prevalent, and you don't have anything to go on other than your experience like me, but you know that suicide is more prevalent mm-hmm. because you live in the world and you've heard the statistics over the last several decades versus the decades before. I'd like on the backside of you talking about how this affected you at 16, before you ever knew it was going to be a part of your journey with your husband. How do you think we get to a place, or can we get to a place with young people where suicide is not on the table as readily as it seems to be nowadays? I know that's really complicated, and I want you mm-hmm. to start by sharing about how Raceland's loss affected you at that point. But do you feel like you can kind of tackle both of those a little bit?
Yeah, I'll definitely try my best to. Starting with what I think my biggest challenge was at 16 with losing Raceland is, I think it was the school. Going to high school when this happened, and I went to a pretty big populated high school, and a lot of people knew Raceland just because she had gone to school in Arizona too, so she had gone to school with a lot of them. And I think it was the stigma around it and what people had to say about it, especially teenagers young teenagers and talking and gossiping and guessing and spreading rumors about it. It just felt like I couldn't escape it. Already dealing with the grief and all the emotions with losing my best friend, the person I would talk to almost every single day. And then having to go to school and not have a breakdown in every class, especially with people staring and talking. And a lot of people were considerate about it. A lot of the teachers handled it really well. And there was definitely discussions that were had at school. My guidance counselor was great. It was mostly the challenge with my peers. And that caused me to not want to go to school. I missed a lot of school because of it. I mean, after losing Raceland, and then I had no motivation to go to school. I didn't want to face people. I didn't want to hear people talking about it. I didn't want to feel the need to correct them because they didn't know her. They were just talking about what they thought happened. So I switched to online school for the rest of the semester, and that really, it was really isolating. It was really isolating, and it felt like I had no option to either go to school and have to face that every day or stay at home every single day and isolate and not be around any friends and struggle with, either way, it was a struggle. So I think that's definitely what my biggest challenge, already a confusing age and a confusing time, and adding this on top of that, it was very difficult. And I think a way to take it off the table, I think, is talking about it. Honestly, parents, kids, peers, school, it wasn't the first one, the first student from our high school that passed, that died by suicide. And it always felt like it was secretive, covered up, talked about negatively, instead of really getting under the why or supporting each other. It was just really a lot of tension and, yeah, just that secretiveness, cover it up type of feelings behind it, and instead of being openly talked about. And so I think, yeah, just covering that topic from school, at home, with your friends, even just saying, I'm always here for you, especially people who have lost friends by suicide. Just having an open discussion always about it, always having that topic on the table. If you want to talk about this, if you don't want to talk about it now, we can talk about it later. Just always having that on the table to discuss.
I think that's so important that you bring up, and I want to go back. We'll go back to how Quentin's loss affected you in the shadow of already having a loss like this, because I know there's the independent piece of it, but there's also the crossover piece that you had already dealt with suicide loss. So, but I want to talk real briefly about what you said about how the peers were what made it so difficult, because I have a small window into that with what some things that my youngest son, who at the time Alex died, was 18. He had just graduated high school. So he didn't go back to the actual classroom scene at high school, right, where everybody knew him and Alex. But he did still have all of the same friends. He still has a lot of them to this day. Like, he's one of those people that still is tight-knit with both girls and guys that he went to high school with, and see a lot of them daily still, which at 26, that's a lot of years later. So these were people that he had grown up all the way through childhood with. So even though it was summer after high school, that was who he was spending his time with, was those people. And he came to me one time and said how, and he was in tears and we were talking, and it was after he had started college, but he was only 10 minutes away. So even though he was required to live there, he was home a lot because we had just lost Alex. So I wasn't even sure he was going to be able to go. He chose to go. But one of the things he said to me is, because he was seeing his normal friends, the friends that knew him and Alex, many of them had knew Alex as a friend, not just Alex and Park were only 2 years apart. So I think it's important to paint that picture because it's the same kind of picture you had with these people, knew you and they knew Ray Slynn. I'm still perplexed by, and hoping that to demystify it a little bit eventually, how young people who are dying by suicide way too readily in today's world, how they react once somebody, a peer, has died by suicide. Because one of the things what Parker said to me in that moment was, I'm really struggling with what some of my friends are talking about. They know how affected he is. These are his childhood friends. They know how close he was to Alex. And yet they were using suicidal references and things in casual conversations very callously around Parker. And he was very confused by why these people that loved him so much would do things like say, my day was just so bad, blank. We won't go into specifics, but they would be callous about the term of using taking their life or wanting to die or things, or even making light of suicide sometimes. And I didn't really know what to say to him, to be honest with you, Bobby, because that wasn't something I had experienced with my peers, even though I had peers that maybe didn't have any idea how to talk to me or didn't talk to me or ignored it because they were uncomfortable. I didn't have that side of anybody talking callously that was in my inner circle around me. I don't know which one's better, to be ignored by the people you need or to be talked to in an inappropriate way by the people you need. They're both horrible, which is a lot of what we deal with, the stigma of suicide. But I wonder what you think about, is it that they're scared themselves? Is it that, now that you can look back and you did extricate yourself from that situation, luckily for your own mental health at the time, but is it because of fear that so many of them have had those thoughts themselves? And instead of knowing they have power to talk about it openly, they almost go towards that mockery or they talk negatively. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that, on why your generation seems to be dying in unprecedented numbers, but yet you're seeing what you saw and Parker saw what he saw in the response?
Yeah.
I know we're going deep down a rabbit hole here, but it's so relevant for, yeah.
Yeah, 100%. I can only guess. I can only assume what was going on and like why. Because how you said with making light, had your son had some friends that were making light of the situation or joking. I had the same things happen. People making jokes about it, not taking it seriously, or saying she just wanted attention. I would say that was the biggest one I heard. Even sitting at the same lunch table with girls that I went all through school with, Raceland went through school with, some I would not expect these things from, and here they are joking about it and then saying she just did it for attention, she just wanted attention. I think that comes from a place of maybe fear, but also not understanding. Maybe they don't have these thoughts, they don't understand it, they don't understand how somebody could get there. And so when all their friends are discussing it and they chime in, they really don't understand any level of it. They had never experienced it themselves or any mental health issues. And so it's just kind of pulling something out there. I don't think any of them were malicious or it was them trying to be rude, but I just don't think they had put a lot of thought behind it, unfortunately. It was just thrown out there and it was really hard to hear. And I'm glad I walked away from not only that lunch table where they were talking about it and they know I was, how close I was with her, but from that environment, the school and switching to online, because I couldn't deal and cope with hearing that every single day.
Well, thanks for addressing that, but it validates what I've suspected for a while, which is fear obviously plays a role because it is, this kind of loss creates fear, but also ignorance, sheer actual ignorance of understanding. And going back to what I said about my generation not seeing it as a possibility, we also were a generation and the ones before us as well, but we also were still that kind of one of the last generations that had that really thought process pushed into us that suicide was selfish. People that die by suicide are engaging in a selfish act and don't care or think about any of their loved ones. We know that to be the farthest thing from the truth at this point. However, you still have a lot of that rhetoric that comes down, especially because I'm the parent of children that aren't much different. And well, my youngest son's 26, so I'm your parents' age generation. And so your generation has heard my generation say those things their whole life. So I hope that we're not more than a generation or two from starting to turn this dialogue around and having your generation raising children with entirely different, healthier conversations that are going to happen, not just about mental health and suicide loss, obviously about a lot of important things. But it's like that old dialogue, because I know I was somebody who thought that too, because it's how I was raised. It's what I was told. My husband said he heard his dad say it more than once in his life. And the minute you lose a child by suicide, you understand that it's not that cut and dry. It's not that cut and dry. Mental health isn't that cut and dry. None of these things are. So thanks for at least being willing to address that. We don't have a solution, but you're right, which is why I do what I do. I think conversations, persistent conversations that are hard, are the only way we're going to make a difference, because we do have to raise kids that understand that they have to be empowered in their own mental health. We have to get rid of the stigma and raise people that understand that mental health isn't any different than our physical health and we should treat it the same. But if we can educate people and talk about these things, then it no longer is some concept that they don't understand, right? So now let's switch gears and talk about losing Quentin. And I'm just so sorry. I'm so sorry to realize that you've had both of these losses again. And talk about your lovely husband and a couple of things. You know, it takes a while to even start to absorb it. But after the shock and all those things, do you feel like having lost Raceland prepared you at all? It's a bad way to even put it, because I don't know how else. Our words are so inadequate in this loss, right? We can't come up with words that make sense. But do you feel like it did prepare you at all? And then I want you to talk about, because this was new and I'm glad that you hadn't told me this part before, but in hearing your whole story today and talking about how Quentin was rambling and it wasn't like him. You said that a couple of times. This wasn't like him. Do you have any idea of what happened that caused that? And you said you didn't see it coming, and we'll go into the other stuff here in a minute. But what do you think happened that day? And did you feel any better equipped to deal with his loss because of your loss of Raceland?
Yeah, I'll start with his rambling, and this wasn't like him. It was the furthest thing from him. His personality, he was always very level. Looking for a why when you're looking for advice and you're looking for a reason. Somebody to comfort you, somebody to talk to, somebody to make you laugh. He was the point person. He was the person you would go to. So it's the person that you find most level-headed, the person that you find you go to for things. And when that switch flips, it's just a little jarring of what is going on. So when he called me and he was upset, I didn't know how to handle that situation. I did as best as I could, but I think it was a mixture of many things that I think got him to that point. His switching his work schedule, I think he was extremely sleep deprived. He had just worked from 3 a.m. till, I think he got off early that day, so it was around 9. He didn't sleep all day. And I was like, are you going to sleep? You should take a nap because you have to get up at midnight and work till 8 a.m. I don't want you to be tired. And he didn't sleep all day. And he seemed normal again. What I've already talked about, planning what we were going to eat that week. What do you want for lunch the next day? And he finally got so exhausted, he fell asleep for only probably 45 minutes to an hour around 10:30. And then I stayed up and I woke him up at 11:30 so he could go to work, which is only 10 minutes down down the street from our house. And I could just tell how exhausted he was. And he went to work from midnight till 8 a.m. And I don't know what happened within that time frame. I don't know if something happened at work.
I would guess nobody has filled in the details for you because you still don't know. Okay.
Yeah. So my mother-in-law worked with him, his mom, and she saw him that morning when he left for work, left from work, and said he was fine. And nothing seemed weird. And so there is a lot of spaces that it's just speculation. So there's no, I don't know what happened within that time frame, but at some point, I think something triggered him is what I assume. And he spiraled, and that's when he called me. Is when I looked at my phone after they gave it to me, I had like an hour of he was called trying to call me. And when we got his phone back from the detectives, and I went through his call log to try to get inside his mind, what was going on? How did we go from the night before to now? To try to put those pieces together. And he wasn't just trying to call me. He was trying to call me. He was trying to call his friends from the military. He was trying to call his parents. He was trying to call many different people. And I think maybe he was trying to put the pieces together. Is maybe he was trying to find somebody to talk to, or I don't know if he was saying goodbyes or having somebody talk him out of it, but that's really all I've got to work on with what happened in that short time frame of how did things go so wrong so fast. And well, your other question was how the challenges, like the difference in challenges from Bracelin until Quentin, right?
Yeah, kind of just having gone into losing Quentin by suicide, not being your first suicide loss, and not for suicide loss that was close to you, right? And not just someone, a very best friend, and then your husband. That's very significant. So do you feel like it better prepared you to kind of know how to deal with your loss, or do you feel like it didn't really play in at all?
I think a bit of kind of weird to explain it, but both is I knew the effects of suicide and the wakes, the giant wakes of grief and trauma and everything that is in the past that stays behind after a suicide. And so I knew what was coming, and I knew it was going to last a long time. But the difference of, I think, age with Raceland, I was so young. I was still living at home. I was still in school. I didn't live with Raceland. She was my best friend. But with Quentin, my husband, I lived with him. We had been together for years. At that point, I was planning a life with him. We had shared responsibilities, shared bills. It was just a whole nother pile on top of, with Raceland, all I had to do was deal with just the emotional side of it and the grief. With Quentin, it was, you still have to do this. You are now the point person and have to try to figure out how to plan a funeral, how to the finances, how to do everything on top of it. It was just like another load that I was not prepared for. And I think that was the biggest challenge with Raceland. I got to sit with it. And with Quentin, it was just go, you have this to do on top of mourning your husband.
Thanks for breaking that down, because that would have been kind of anticipated, you saying, but yet you put more clarity on it than I would have been able to. So that's, I understand what you said, and thanks for saying all that. Now let's talk for a minute about support afterwards, and then I want to branch into talking about Quentin as a Marine. But let's talk real briefly about, you had told me when we talked before, because that support has been really crucial for you and helping you grieve. the loss, especially of Quentin, but I have no doubt it's also touched on the loss of Raceland because that's part of your life journey. But you said that you found a support group that made all the difference, and everybody that's listening knows how I didn't start off this way because I didn't know what I didn't know and I couldn't find what I needed. I now believe firmly that support is a necessity for all suicide loss survivors, support of those that understand, meaning some form of community that's lost people to suicide, because grief support's important, but I don't think it should. If people can't find specific suicide loss support, then keep looking, because I think it adds an element to your healing that isn't touched on in a general grief situation, if that makes sense. Talk about the support that you received and why it was so transformative for you.
Yeah, with Raceland, I didn't really seek support. I had my family and her family, and I think that's what made all the difference in the world with Raceland's passing, was just how supportive I wasn't family, but they treated me like family. And I stayed in touch with them. I still stay in touch with them. Raceland's mom was at Quentin's funeral for me and dropped everything to just be there for me and was like, do you need help with this and this? Years after Raceland passed. And I think that's what I was so grateful with Raceland, was just how amazing her family was, and sister, grandmother, stepdad, mom. That made all the difference in the world. And with Quentin, again, I feel very lucky and grateful to have all the support that came with that is my family. Quentin's family was just grieving. They were grieving their son, brother, cousin, nephew, grandson, and they were all just there for me. And they did so much for me after that. And I still, even with all of that, I still was like, I need extra support. I need to give myself, I was going to do what I wish I did after Raceland and what I wish Quentin did after Raceland. And so I seeked out a support group, and I found such an amazing support group that was very helpful. So for a couple months, while I was still living in Oklahoma, I went to the support group, and the kindest person ever ran it. Her name is Darlene, and I believe she still runs it. I'm in Arizona now, but while I was in Oklahoma, and just going and sharing my story, and it's a group nobody wants to be a part of, but I was very, again, grateful to have found this group of people. And she had also lost her husband. So just finding people who understand and a non-judgmental environment was very helpful. And I had also sought out therapy, and my therapist was amazing. And I think those two things, among books and other things, were a great foundation for me to help me get back on my feet. But I would say that all of that combined was the support that I needed at that time.
Yeah. Thanks for being willing to talk to that, because I think so many people that many people would consider the peripheral people, like in your case, I'll say a friend, right? For Raceland, I wouldn't say a wife is considered a peripheral person, but lots of times friends feel very outside the primary people that lost somebody's loss, when their loss may be as important as anybody's, but they feel like they're somehow on the outside. Therefore, they feel like they can't even seek support, right? Because, well, it's not my sister, or it's not my child, or fill in the blank, right? I'm just, air quotes, a friend. And that's so unfair, right? That's so unfair. Mm-hmm. But it's a reason a lot of people don't necessarily get the support they need, because they feel like they can't ask for it, or they're not the right relationship to the person to ask for it. And with Quentin being your spouse and having lost somebody before, you knew enough that you knew you were going to need support to get through this. So I commend you for finding that support. But I'm also so glad you found the supportive community that you did, especially in that support group. But it sounds like you have amazing family and they continued to be amazing. So I'm really glad, but you highlight the fact that support in different areas, a therapist, support groups, family, it all works together to help buoy you up and support you during the time. Let's talk really quickly about, before we go into Quentin being a Marine, because this will segue into that, I believe, but you and I talked briefly about post-loss support not being what it should be. And a lot of times for many of us, and I'm putting myself in that same place as you are, that horrible way that things are handled that set the stage for the worst trauma of our life are sometimes from the very moment we're contacted by police or authorities. And you said you had your situation with Quentin and how the police and the detectives, I'm just going to say my words, are dehumanized you and your family and Quentin's family during the process, did nothing but add trauma layers to your already traumatic situation. Can you speak to that a little bit? Because I don't think the situation is very uncommon. I think it's fairly common, but it has to change. And this is how we change these things. We draw attention to them.
It did add, again, more layers of trauma on top of the most traumatic situation, the most traumatic day of my life. And with how the police and the detectives handled it, this is something very important that I have wanted to talk about, is, again, yeah, how they handled it was really impactful in a negative way. With finding out when we get there, my mother-in-law, me, and his best friend, our roommate, got the brunt of, again, it felt like they dehumanized the whole situation. There was no emotion, there was no consoling, and there was a lot of snide remarks and unfortunate comments made. And my mother-in-law hadn't known at the time, just finding out how he had passed, which I knew, but just finding out, you're not really talking about that. She asked the police officer to go look at him and see if there was anything that they could do. Obviously, she's upset saying this, and he comes back, he says, "I'm no medical professional, ma'am, but there is no way we can save him." And that just makes her more upset. Then they pull us all separately into cop cars. I had already started calling people, and that was just, you know, one of my trauma responses. I was just like, I need to get, you know, his dad, his sister, everybody here, because his sister had also lived with us, but she wasn't there. I need to get everybody here for his mom, for me, for his friend. And so I was just calling people. And his sister had just gotten there, and then they wouldn't even let us hug her. They wouldn't let us hug my sister-in-law, and they pulled us all into separate cop cars. His best friend was in there for, I think he said, about 2 hours. 2 hours. My mother-in-law I don't know how long she was in a cop car, and then I was pulled in a cop car, and I felt like I was going to pass out. It was really hot. It's in the middle of summer in Oklahoma, and it was just so hot in there. I felt like I was going to pass out. I was going to throw up. And the cops, they kind of just locked me in there and then walked away. And we were like, wait till the detectives get here. I couldn't wait outside. I had to wait in the cop car. And then they go into my house, and I see my dog run out of the house and starts running down the street. And we're in a pretty busy area, so I don't want my dog to get hurt. And so I'm banging on the window, like, let me out. They're just ignoring me. Let me out. I need to go get my dog. They finally let me out of the car, and I have to go down the street. Thankfully, my neighbors also helped grab my dog. And then I walked back and they were just very rude. And then when the detectives got there, I can't really speak on my mother-in-law's story just because everything's a blur, or his best friend's stories, because I know they only told me a couple of things, but I don't know how they were really treated. But then the detectives pulled me in the detective's car and talked to me, and I was still wearing my work clothes and my work logo. And he said, again, it was just accusatory, is what their tone and their words felt like. And he goes, oh, my son starts there tomorrow. It's expensive. I hope it's worth it. I can't even tell you. I was speechless. I was speechless. I didn't want to even answer any of his questions after that, because I was just like, this is the worst day of my life, and you're going to talk about how expensive this daycare where I work at is. It makes no sense. It made no sense. And my mother-in-law had told me that they, I don't remember if it was my mother-in-law, with all this, your brain doesn't hold on to a lot of things, but they said, shitty day, huh? To my mother-in-law. And when they told me that, I was, again, speechless, just because there was no compassion. There was no compassion that day. And with everything after that, and they finally let us out of the cop cars, finally let us see our family, and finally let us inside the house after hours of being outside in the heat. Then a week later, a couple days later, they gave me back his phone, and I asked if they had found anything that just pointed to answers. And they said, well, I don't know, you'll have to go through it yourself. I was like, okay. I was just, at this point, I wasn't shocked by any of how they were handling it and their behavior. And then about another week later, the detective's wife thinks it's okay to follow me on Facebook. I did not accept. But I told all of his family. I think she just followed me on Facebook. I don't know why. I don't know. His wife wasn't there that day. How does she know about my information? How does she know my name? Why would a police officer, her husband, think it's okay to share my information with his family, and then they think it's okay for them to reach out to me through social media? I just thought it was very insulting.
I'm just so sorry that was your experience. I'm so sorry that it's so many people's experience. And to hear you talk about this, there's a lack of standards, there's a lack of education, a lack of accountability, and a lack of compassion and kindness, right? We should be leading with those things, and we should be ending with those things, the compassion and kindness. And they're just lacking in so many situations where first responders are concerned. And I would love nothing more than to highlight first responder situations that are doing the right thing, as well as ones that are doing not so good. Unfortunately, I haven't had too many step forward that are, hey, let me tell you how great this organization handled it. I'm actually going to seek out one of those, because I do want to make sure that this doesn't seem like a situation where I just want to talk disparagingly about law enforcement or first responders, because that's not the case at all. It just seems like in this very stigmatized, conflicting death, that there are so many first responders. So that includes EMTs or firemen that may come to the scene. That includes police officers. It can include coroners. My situation, I had both law enforcement and coroners speak to us very callously. Now, they were not treating, you guys got treated almost in a criminal manner in the beginning. And there has to be a balance, because my complaint is that there was nothing about Alex's death that was treated in a criminal, meaning from a, I have a father, ex-father-in-law who spent 30 years as a detective. And so when he found out some of the things he did, his head just spun. He was like, what do you mean they didn't have crime tape there when you got there a few hours after Alex's body was removed? What do you mean that you guys weren't asked certain questions and things? Because he said you're supposed to work backwards with a suicide and assume possible foul play and then work to the place that you see that it was self-harm versus foul play. And there was none of that with Alex's. It was treated very callously, like, oh, it's just a college suicide. And they cleared the scene very quickly. They didn't investigate to see whether anything else could have gone on. And not that I would have wanted the extreme of, that you had, where they just suddenly criminalize us, but there should be a happy medium. There should be compassion for the families and understanding on our part that we're innocent victims of this. And yes, that doesn't mean the family shouldn't be questioned as part of it, but in a compassionate, caring way. And that's not how you were treated at all. They also shouldn't be talked to and said callous, flippant things. And we were treated the same way too. I think I talked about this very early on in my podcast, but when we were going to Kirksville, it was a couple hour drive. We found out, and within a few hours we're there. The coroner on the phone said to me, I don't know why you're coming. And he said these words, your son is padlocked in a black body bag. I don't know why you're coming. That was his statement to a grieving mom. And through my shock and tears, I said something to the effect, I don't have a clear memory, as I'm sure you understand, of, I have to come. I don't know where else would I go. My son is there. One of it's disbelief. One of it's me still thinking if we get there, we're going to find out this isn't true. Because, and yes, as parents, you want to see them. You want to be sure it's really them, all these things. But that wasn't even at front of my mind. It was, where else would I go? My child is there. And then I remember defaulting to, I have to get his dog and his things at the very least. But for me to be met with, I don't know why you're coming, lady. Your child is locked in a bag, is about as callous as you can get. So you've, me hearing you, you hearing me, we fully understand being treated like we're in the way, like we weren't human, like this wasn't the worst day of our life, just like a piece of paperwork, just like we were in the way. And that's got to change. And so, yes, I'd love nothing more than to highlight some agencies that are doing it right, because I know some are. It's not the common story. The common story is people that are handled by some sort of first responder. It's not happening in the way that it should be, which does go back to me saying education, standards, accountability. We know that needs to happen in law enforcement in more than one place. But absolutely, where suicide loss is concerned and how victims are treated at the time of loss and how they're given information and support and all those things. So I'm sorry that was a part of your story. And now we're going to segue into the other difficult part, which is Quentin as a Marine. He was 9 months out of the Marine Corps, working at Herzog, where he had started before he was out, correct? So even though his employment hadn't changed, his military status had, and after 4 years in active duty as a young person, I want you to talk about how you believe his service affected his mental health and how then getting out of the service made that situation even worse because of the lack of acclimation that they did for him in acclimating him to civilian life after 4 years of, it's diehard in the Marines, right? So not to say all other service branches are, but, you know, they're really diehard in the Marines. So to then leave the Marines and have no support on how to acclimate, you believe played a role, correct?
I believe it 100% played a role in his passing, yes. For how, when he was in, how it affected his mental health is, I think, just how they treated mental health in general in the military. The stories that he would tell me, the stories I would hear from his friends that were also in the military, just all came to the general consensus of being scared to speak up about their mental health in fear of, he said, you speak up about your mental health, you're struggling, especially with suicidal thoughts, they kind of shun you cast you aside, put you in a box, is what he described it as, of with like a box with like a warning label, is what he said it felt like. So they would really go to each other instead of the people above them to talk about things, to be there for each other. And again, it's just really stigmatized if you're struggling with anything, is you're a Marine, you're in the military, hold your own, figure it out. Like, you need to be stronger than this. And so I think that's really how most of them, it's just really beat into them, is that is you don't struggle, you're a Marine. If you do, figure it out. And if you talk about it, again, put in a box with a warning label. And so that really set the standard, the precedent on that. And so when he got out, it wasn't really the transition. It wasn't really a transition. For his transition, if I remember correctly, it was 2 weeks, and it was basically seminars of how to use your GI Bill, how to sign up for college or a trade school, and I believe how to apply and interview for a job. And that was it. And there was, he said, one counseling session. And the counseling session, I was like, oh, that's good. What did they talk to you about? And he said they just asked him what his plan was, relationship-wise, career-wise. And he said he was married. He already has a job lined up, and he's moving here. And they said, cool, have a good day. You're good to go. And I was kind of shocked by that, because I wish there was more of a transition out, just like boot camp. I watched a TED Talk about it. Is just like boot camp in, there should be boot camp back out into civilian life, not just 2 weeks where you're attending some classes, not really one-on-one, then one counseling session. They don't really dive deep. Good, you're good to go. Here are your papers. Have a good life. And so, yeah, I wasn't really prepared for how hard the transition out was. And I don't know if it's for everybody, but, you know, just speaking from a spouse's experience of what I noticed with him, is it was really hard losing the community he had around him. Is we were moving back home to be with his family, which I thought that it was amazing for him to be back around his family and in his home state, but also losing that brotherhood. You could always keep in contact, but it's hard when you don't see them every single day. And those are the people that understood him most, I feel like, because of the things that they went through together. So losing that dynamic and that community, I think really was really difficult for him. And so when I saw it, especially in going through his phone logs of his passing, those are some of the people he tried to reach out to. And yeah, just all of that combined was really, I believe it was really hard for him.
What I hear you saying paints a picture of a young man who was conflicted and imploding inside and had nowhere to turn because of the, I'm going to call it this because I'm not, I can, the brainwashing that had occurred as part of him being in the military. He didn't know what to do with those feelings. He knew what he had been told about the weakness and all the things that you can't do. You just have to figure it out. And so instead of knowing how to reach out in a moment of crisis when he couldn't reach somebody, when let's assume, hate that word, but let's guess that he was struggling prior to the day that he came unwound. Undoubtedly, on some level, he was. But didn't have the ability to reach out. And then by the time he was in that crisis mode and his brain had started to break in that moment where that decision suddenly seemed logical versus what it should seem like, which is illogical and a solution, right? So, or a permanent solution to a temporary problem, he didn't have the tools because of the training and the talk in his mind, the narrative that he had been given in the military took over, and it does for many soldiers. And so by the time he was literally imploding And his demons were taking over, it was too late. And like you said, it's so interesting that they have this whole process to acclimate you into the military. And it's weeks. It's like 6 weeks, 6 or 8 weeks that they're at boot camp. It's not like it's 6 days or 6 hours. And they're usually cut off from their family, right? And so that they can bring them in and train them and get them in a mindset for the military. But then when they leave, it's a quick exit interview and a bye-bye, good luck. And that's so interesting to me that we do that. That's what we do. And even knowing that he had suicide loss in his past and things like that, and he's young and he has a young wife, there should be this whole like place they can tool his boot camp or exit boot camp, if you will, if that were to exist. There would be a way they could tool that to be sure he's prepared in all the ways, not only with a job, but in handling being with your spouse on a daily basis as a non-military member. And he had lived away from you at one point and things. And so no acclimation process to that at all. And in his case, the being scared to speak up becomes a point that it was, I'm sure he was carrying extreme shame, right? Why can't I figure this out? Had to be going through his head on some level. And it's so sad that part of that can't be, well, there's places for me to reach out and I won't be judged and all of those things. So in talking about all this, it's just so heartbreaking. There's nothing not heartbreaking about your story and how things were handled as far as losing Quentin. To take just a minute to think about the hopeful side of things and the positive side of things. The first thing I want you to do is share one of your favorite memories or something favorite of yours about Quentin to bring to the forefront the wonderful person and friend and husband that he was and son and all those things.
Big question, because there's so many wonderful memories with Quentin. I think my favorite that I think about when I need to laugh or just to brighten, you think about all the negative things surrounding their passing, especially when they pass in this way. But something that always makes me laugh, and I've told the story to every single person that I have met, and I repeat it to his family countless amount of times, is when we lived in California and he was not a fan of the beach, but my sister was staying with us and she loves the beach. So I dragged him out of the house and me, my sister, and my husband, Quentin, went to Thousand Steps Beach. And parking was not fun as in California. It's always a disaster. And so we finally park, and none of us are in the best mood because we drove around forever trying to find parking. And I said, Quentin, I have my purse. Why don't you hand me the keys and your phone and wallet that's in your pocket? I'll put it in my purse. And he said, no, I've got it. I'm not going to lose it. I said, okay. And so we walked down all these steps, not quite 1,000, but it felt like it. And we walked down onto the beach and he sees this rock that's a little bit out into the ocean. And he's always been a kid at heart. So he runs over to the rock and he gets on top of the rock and my sister like, what are you doing? And he does the Karate Kid kick and does a super high kick. And I just see something, I couldn't tell what it was, fly out from his pocket, his swimsuit pocket, and then plop down into the ocean. And I was like, oh my gosh. I said, Quentin, I yelled it across the beach. I said, Quentin, your phone. And then he pulls out his phone from his pocket. He goes, it's right here. And then I was like, your wallet. He pulls out his wallet from his other pocket. He goes, it's right here. And then I said, the keys. He goes and he taps all his pockets and he taps all over his shirt. And he goes, and his jaw just drops open. And he just looks into the ocean. He goes, oh my gosh. And so what fell into the ocean was our car keys our house keys and basically any key that he had on there. We didn't have any second set of keys. So we try to, and it's really rocky, windy, big waves beach, so we can't go into the water because it's all rocks around the shore. So we spend like an hour going up and down the shore trying to look for the keys. And thankfully we had our phones on us. And so he called a locksmith. And so we spent, but he had an old, I believe it was a 98 or 99 Pontiac Bonneville. So very old. So the locksmith didn't have the things to make the keys for that old of a car. So he had to replace the whole part where the key goes into. And so we spent hours doing that. We're hot and dehydrated. And then we finally get home. I'm like, oh, we're so excited to be home. And we had forgot that our house keys were there. So then we had to wait outside because it was a weekend and the office was closed. Had to call a locksmith again to come over and do the locks for our house. And they had to drill a hole through the lock. And then we finally get inside. We invited our friends who live in the same apartment complex over, and we just had everybody over for food and drinks and everything to unwind from that day. And then he ended up having a really good night. Yeah.
Now, and I bet he learned that he needed to give you the keys next time, right? To put them
in. Oh, yes. Yes. He never said that he'd hold on to them again.
Share with everybody listening, what was your big why with regard to wanting to come on and talk about this and do the podcast?
I think my why is many things. One, to bring light to the military and how they handle mental health and how I think that should be different. And there should be things in place that better prepare not only Marines, but any branch getting out of the military and acclimating back to civilian life. And also how they deal with losses in the military and how they bring support to their peers after losing somebody. And then also with at least my experience of just humanizing that experience around the family and their loss and what they're going through, and not adding trauma on top of that from the police and the detectives. Again, just my experience, but I just felt like maybe there could be a program that better prepares them and know how to deal with that. And also just to share his story and Raceland's story. And I never want to stop saying their names. I think that's one of the main things, is especially as time goes on and the loss, their passing day gets further and further back. We're not moving on, we're moving forward. And I still want to say their name. And I try to say it as much as I can and talk about them and tell stories about them, because they are just as important now as when they were alive.
You're speaking to legacy, and that's so important. Legacy is so important. And you're right. Unless we continue to say their names, how are they remembered? So how important, how brave. I'm so thankful that you shared Raceland and Quentin with us. And through just this and all the other things you're going to go on to do, their names will continue to be said. They will have people that haven't heard of them continue to hear of them. And this is just one small way to do that. And I applaud you for doing that. Can you leave us with a message of hope for any friends, spouses, siblings, anybody that's listening? Can you leave us with your message of hope, Bobby?
I would say, and I said this at Quentin's funeral, is that you are needed. You are loved, and there's always going to be somebody that will listen. And we don't move on. We don't move on. We move forward. And it's okay, and you should not feel guilty And it should be encouraged to find joy without feeling guilt. And your grief and joy can coexist.
Amazing words. And you're brave and wonderful and amazing. And I'm so thankful that we talked. I just hate the reason that we needed to. And I'm going to say goodbye for now, but thanks, Bobby. Thanks for coming on and sharing your story. We'll talk soon.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Grievers, it is my hope that from today, you will take that which serves you and simply leave the rest. I would love to connect with you, and the best way to do that is to start out on my website, where the first thing you'll find is a video recorded message from me. And then from there, you can find everything I offer. The online Zoom support groups, the books I've written, ways to connect for the podcast, and an entire resource library assembled to help all suicide loss grievers find the resources that they need to help them along their healing journey. Please go to theleftoverpieces.com. From there, I hope that we can connect, and I hope that you too can discover that we truly are better together. If anything that you've heard in today's episode resonates with you, I would ask that you please subscribe to get notified every week of my new episodes. And then take a moment to rate and review me on Apple Podcasts so that more grievers like us can find this podcast and this community. It is from my own experience of finding myself sitting amid the leftover pieces of my own shattered heart that I can tell you that while it seems impossible in the early days, it is possible to put those pieces back together and be okay again. And every week, we'll be right here providing more comfort, hope, and community. So until next week, I'll sign off today with some words from one of my Alex's favorites, Peter Pan. Never say goodbye, because goodbye means going away, and going away means forgetting. Grievers, no one here is forgetting. Talk soon. Are you a mom like me who has lost a child by suicide, and you want to ensure that who they are and the amazing life they lived are remembered? I have found that after child loss, creating a legacy is a critical piece of our healing journey. Let me tell you about the Because They Lived Mom's Legacy Compilation Group Writing Project. I have developed this project where you can create a true lasting legacy for your child while you also experience deep personal healing alongside other moms doing the same thing. This powerful project encompasses support and creativity, as well as elements of both narrative therapy and grief companioning. At the end of just 13 weeks, the chapter you write will be published in a very special compilation book so that their memories and stories will live on. I promise you will receive all of the guidance, support, and help that you need, so you do not need to be a writer in order to author your child's story. Go to www.theleftoverpieces.com and click the Get Support tab to find out more, and then maybe take a look at the volumes that are already published. Then remember to click the button and schedule a call with me today.